This is HPC Wire Soundbite, your weekly source of commentary and insight on the HPC stories shaping the industry. With Michael Feldman, editor of HPC Wire, and Addison Snell, CEO of Intersect 360 Research. And now, here are your hosts, Michael Feldman and Addison Snell.
Encanto cluster to be sold for parts.
And a one-off supercomputer to map the universe.
Good morning for HPC Wire Soundbite for January 11, 2013. Available every Friday on iTunes and Stitcher. I'm Michael Feldman, editor of HPC Wire, and I'm joined today by Chris Willard of Intersect 360 Research. Hey, good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Michael.
Hey, thanks for subbing for Addison today. I guess he's on the road and busy, but glad to have you back on the show.
Well, I'm glad to be here.
So news is starting off a little slow, but we did see a couple developments. One of these stories is something we've been following for a long time, this Encanto supercomputer in New Mexico, this SGI Intel-based machine that was started up there back in 2007 and was a, you know, I think got up to number three on the list. It was 172 teraflops. And the idea was to make this a sort of a utility computer for the state, for both private and public users of HPC, but that never quite worked out. And so there's been a lot of churning about what to do with the system because it's not paying for itself. And it looks like this week they've sort of reached some sort of an agreement with some of the universities there to sell parts of that to these universities in New Mexico. I think it was the University of New Mexico, New Mexico State, and then this other institution, New Mexico Institute of Mining Technology. So they're going to recoup some of the investment, but that was a very expensive system. It was like $9 million going in, and they're going to sell it off for a few hundred thousand at most. So not a great end to, not a great story for a premier supercomputer that just didn't seem to work out.
Yeah, it's a sad story, and it's an unfortunate situation in that you lose a computing facility to help science, engineering, and hopefully industry from a sort of an operational concept or operational model that just didn't seem to work.
Yeah, and I think at the time, you know, when we reported on it, we were a little skeptical if this would work. Of course, this is the government trying to, I mean, we do have these government-private-public partnerships, but it was trying to insinuate itself sort of into the market there and thinking at one time that it could actually sell, you know, this basically government-sponsored computer to private companies and recoup the cost there. But that never worked out. In fact, you know, one of our readers wrote in and said, you know, the New Mexico legislature actually killed a bill that would have allowed that machine to be part of a business model for the for-profit organizations. I think there must have been some uncomfortable feeling about it, you know?
That is a very difficult model to present at any level whatsoever. As soon as a government entity appears to be setting up a private business, a lot of sparks fly, and it becomes a very hot political issue. Certainly if you're running a successful business or trying to create a business, and all of a sudden a government entity comes in and says, "Well, we're going to do this too," the playing field becomes very, very uneven, and just about everyone who has a business gets nervous, whether it's their business or not, and the political pressure to keep such an entity going is the political pressure to stop such competition becomes enormous, and it becomes impossible to really set up these types of plans. The closest that you get is university business collaborations, but even there's usually some indication of a collaborative effort where at least some effort is made to tie in the selling of the computer cycles to the overall mission of the university in terms of education or creating and advancing knowledge. And certainly it's not done on a major level.
Right, and we have to remember this was all started back in 2007. This was before sort of the rise of commercial cloud computing in a really big way, and certainly before the rise of HPC utility computing even as it stands today. I mean, this is before Amazon got into the HPC business in that sense. So they didn't really have a good idea of how this would work. I think there were a lot of good intentions by the government back then, but obviously the plan wasn't fully mapped out. I mean, even back then, there were some utility systems and services back then, but it was all sort of pre the market. Now, you guys have been studying this for a while, though. I mean, you've taken some surveys of utility computing and cloud. What's the status of this today in the HPC market?
Well, if there is an inflection point for cloud computing, and particularly the utility model of cloud computing, we haven't seen it yet. Cloud computing in terms of overall budget or overall spend, I guess, has been fairly stable at about 3-4% of the market. There are a number of issues that you're looking at. One is the question of trying to repeat what someone is doing in an offsite facility, which, you know, includes all of the software, all of the staffing, all of the hardware, and to do this for a profit or to make enough money to keep your facility going and at the same time provide a service that is less expensive than what the customer would be able to do on their own. You know, that usually occurs for small one-off projects. So the second problem is that someone has to pay for the unused cycles, and that no matter how much shifting around problems and applications and workloads you do, somebody ends up with some unused cycles, and that if it turns out to be the cloud provider, that money has to be made up through increased cloud pricing. The very large companies such as Amazon can do it to a certain degree because they have to carry some excess capabilities anyways, or excess capacities in any case, and they might as well be trying to monetize these.
Right, it seems to make sense for something like Amazon, where, right, the cycles can be shifted much more easily because the volume of users is such, and the volume of their own business is such that there's not those inefficiencies that you get with a system like this size, like an Encanto, as big as it is, I mean, 172 teraflops. It's not like you can hide, you don't have the user base or the application base to use up all those cycles if you were using a utility model. So, but like I said, this was back 2007, where people knew very little about the upcoming market and how these would be used. So I guess we can forgive them somewhat for their ignorance, and yet it was an expensive lesson to learn for New Mexico and some of the other people involved in this project.
I think that it is true that there was a lot of enthusiasm about the cloud model. And there was a hope that the introduction of the internet and cheaper communications would make the utility model viable. Although I must say, in a I told you so sort of way, that we've been trying this model since the 1970s and have yet to find a way to make it viable. Doesn't mean that someone isn't going to find the magic potion in the future, but it hasn't happened yet. I should also point out that about two-thirds of the spending we see on cloud is for private clouds or internal clouds, and that makes a lot more sense in that the capital spending has already been put in place to meet the required workflows and workloads, so that any use of cloud to increase the efficiency of systems you've already had to pay for makes sense, and you don't run into the how do we make a viable economic argument by selling a service to people problem there.
Yeah. Well, let's move on to a little more uplifting news item today. What came on, there was a couple articles that came on the scene about this other supercomputer. This is a custom-built supercomputer built for a radio telescope project called ALMA. It's a system, a radio antenna system array that's put up in the Chilean high desert at 5,000 meters. So this is a very large array of these radio antennas that act as a radio telescope. And it's supposedly the largest ground-based system in the world at this point. I know we've talked about, you know, the square kilometer array in the future, but right now I think this has got top billing. And they've built a machine, a supercomputer around this, but it's not a commodity system. It's not a cluster. It's something they built with their own ASICs to do the sort of signal processing and blending needed by the radio telescope to make all these antennas look like one system. And it's a fairly powerful supercomputer. It's 17 petaops, not flops, but ops. It's not floating point operations. And they've been able to do this very efficiently at you know, a fraction of the price of what they would have been able to do for a general purpose system, and a fraction of the power usage as well. So it's not fully completed yet, but they've got the system up and most of the antennas working. So they basically started this out, and it looks like everything's working.
Yeah, I think this is a fascinating case in that it may be a harbinger of things to come. That is, we've hit a lot of walls in general purpose computing architecture. There's the memory wall, the power wall, the cooling wall, the floor wall, whatever you like. It's becoming more and more difficult to build very large general purpose supercomputers at reasonable prices. And this has opened the door to really a very old strategy, which is to design the computers more to match the application requirements. And the old strategy died simply because we went through a Moore's Law period where the general purpose systems were advancing so fast that by the time you built a special purpose solution, the general purpose solution had been there, done that, and save you a lot of money. And it just didn't make any sense to try to do the special purpose work. And I'm curious to see, though, if there are classes of applications coming on board that will have the both the requirements and the project sizes to make the special purpose solutions more viable. And if we'll see this as a potential future trend in supercomputing.
Right. I mean, obviously, we're looking at radio telescope astronomy here, which is obviously a very specialized application. It's not like we're going to see, hundreds of these radio telescopes being built, but it is well suited. But like you said, there's probably other application areas. I know people have talked about weather modeling, climate modeling as one application area for these institutions to do that. That might be applicable to this sort of strategy as well. And there's other things like genomic sequencing. Certainly we see in the defense and security industry things like data mining of certain types of information might be applicable to that. Basically institutions or organizations that just do, like you said, sort of one or application or domain of applications that are related might benefit from the strategy. I mean, these guys actually got quite a good cost benefit from this. I mean, they estimated that to build a general purpose machine for this, they would have spent $1 billion, probably closer to $100 million for if they'd used GPUs, but still a lot of money. They were able to do this for a tenth of that at $11 million with the ASICs they had. So that's an order of magnitude just upfront cost benefit right there. And then the energy they used to run the system is also just a fraction of what it would have been. It was like 140 kilowatts for the whole system. This is 17 petaops, so it's quite remarkable what they've been able to do just by specializing the hardware for the application.
Yeah, I think the other thing that may have changed over time is the cost and time frame for building a specialized ASIC or putting something together possibly out of GPUs. And that may make this advances in ASIC technologies may make this sort of strategy much more viable now than it has been in the past.
Right, because these tended, if you make a custom ASIC, that's usually a long lead time. In fact, these guys did say they were able to benefit from the fact that this system and this project was planned over a long period of time, so they were able to design the ASIC in that time frame, but yeah, I think you're right. I think these tools have gotten better to do these designs, and it's not quite as onerous as it used to be. So in that sense, it's less expensive and maybe a little more timely. But Yeah, it's not like you can come and maybe design an ASIC in a couple of years if that's what your timeline's about. You just need a cluster to do a certain thing. But for some of these big projects that have these somewhat longer lead times, probably the technology is pretty appropriate now. And yeah, it would be interesting to see, like you said, if more of these types of systems for more specialized applications don't start to maybe get built now. Okay, Chris, well, I think that'll do it for this week. Good stories. Hopefully we'll get some good, a couple of more good stories next week as we start up the new year. Thanks a lot for being on the show in lieu of Addison, and hopefully we'll be talking to you real soon.
I hope so. This is always a pleasure.
All right, thanks.
Thanks for having me on today.
All right, thanks, Chris. So long.
So long.
You've been listening to HPC Wire Soundbite with Michael Feldman and Addison Snell. Got a question or comment for Michael or Addison? Email soundbite@hpcwire.com. HPC Wire Soundbite is available every Friday afternoon from iTunes or at hpcwire.com. HPC Wire, the leading source for global news and information covering the ecosystem of high productivity computing.